Band Group is coming to Macomb Center for the Performing Arts for 3 nights only. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, January 26th, 27th, and 28th at 7:30 p.m. Don't miss out on this exciting performance, The Blue Man Group. Buy tickets at MacombCenter.com or call 586-286-2141.
The Jewish Hour can now be heard on jcastnetwork.org, your portal to Jewish broadcasting. It's also on iTunes and on your smartphone using the Stitcher app. Welcome to the Jewish Hour. I'm your host, Herschel Finman. Sit back, relax, wherever you happen to be. Thank you for tuning in. Where else could you find death metal klezmer fusion on the air? Anywhere else but here. We've got an awesome show for you today. In this half hour of the show, we're going to be interviewing a representative from Sotheby's in New York concerning a Talmud, which was printed in 1506, which was just went up for auction. We've got lots of wonderful music. We're not going to play any more death metal, don't worry. We have one request. The portion of the week is the portion of Bo, which can be found in chapter 10 and following in the book of Exodus. A really amazing Hasidic story. Before we do anything else, let's go right to the news. In Israel, there were 246 attacks by Palestinians in December, down from 326 in November. 3 people were killed and 44 wounded. A planned assassination attempt against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was thwarted as 2 Palestinians from East Jerusalem were arrested. A bomb-making factory was found in their apartment and plans to put an explosive under a stage that Netanyahu was scheduled to speak on. The Prime Minister's office spoke out against a statement that former U.S. Ambassador to Israel Martin Indyk made on Frontline aired on PBS this week. Indyk said, "Netanyahu sat next to me at Rabin's funeral. This is Indyk speaking. I remember Netanyahu saying to me, 'Look at this. He's a hero now. But if he had not been assassinated, I would have beaten him in the elections, and then he would have gone into history as a failed politician.'" Indyk has since retracted the statement. Egypt reinstated its ambassador to Tel Aviv after a 3-year hiatus. The move comes as Israel and Egypt are coordinating efforts against Hamas and ISIS. Counterfeit copies of the new 200-shekel note were discovered in northern Israel. 5 Bedouins from the village of Tuba Zangaria were arrested for forgery and possession of fake banknotes. In a budget-cutting move, Israel is closing its diplomatic offices in Philadelphia, Minsk, El Salvador, Marseille, and the roving ambassador to the Caribbean. There were 851 acts of anti-Semitism in France in 2015, more than doubled the number in 2014. And finally, Israel's flood relief team is helping in Paraguay and England after those 2 countries experienced devastating floods. Israel sent hundreds of packages containing basic necessities, including drinking water and medicines. And that's the news.
Some of the best jobs in the world are in the radio and television industry, and you too can join the workforce in as little as 8 months when you complete your hands-on training at the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts located in Southfield, Michigan. At Specs Howard School, students get to play and learn at the same time. Imagine spending your class time behind the microphone, spinning music and hosting your own radio show, or designing and lighting a set for your own TV program, running a camera, learning to edit, directing a program. When you go to Specs, your day will be anything but dull. And if school is this fun, imagine how exciting it is to work in the growing industry. In addition, the credits you earn while attending Specs Howard School are currently accepted at 14 area colleges and universities. If you've always wanted the best job in the world, call for a tour of Specs Howard School at 248-358-9000. That's 248-358-9000. Or visit them on the web at specshoward.edu. Spex Howard School of Broadcast Arts. This is where you start.
Hey, Shul Finman here. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. We have online Sharon Mintz, who is a senior consultant of Judaism at Sotheby's. We're talking about a recent auction which saw a Talmud from the early 1500s go for auction. How are you today, Sharon?
Hi, good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be speaking with you today.
Oh, the pleasure is all ours indeed. Now, I saw a news thing about the upcoming Talmud being sold. This is a couple of weeks ago before the auction. And some friends of mine were sitting around and we were thinking, let's see, how much would such a thing go for at auction? And my first thing was, I couldn't even afford the archival upkeep of such a thing. But we were thinking, you know, we're thinking 750,000.
Somebody said all like you needed was another
1.3 million. $9.3 million. Would you say this is like the most, the highest fetched auction price for Judaica, Sharon?
It is. It is. At first, we said it was the highest price ever. Ever created for a Hebrew book, and then we realized that it was the highest price of Judaica ever at auction, a Hebrew book, artifact, or any sort, yes.
Okay, let's go back all the way back to 1506. Let's hear about the provenance of this. It's a set of books, I'm assuming.
Yes. The Bamberg Talmud, as it's known, was the first complete edition of the Talmud to be printed. It was printed in Venice in the early 16th century. There were separate tractates of the Talmud printed earlier. The first dated one that we know of is 1483, was printed in the northern Italian town of Sanchino by the Sanchino Jewish family of printers. But it was an expensive undertaking to print an entire edition of the Talmud with many thousands of pages. You needed to buy the paper, you needed to hire labor, you needed to create the fonts. It was enormously expensive to undertake, and only people with an incredible amount of financing and wherewithal would be able to do this. So although there were several dozen tractates printed before Daniel Bamberg came to Venice, set up a printing press, and began this initiative, there was no one complete printed edition in the world up to that point. Hebrew printing had begun in Rome in 1469, so we're well into close to 50 years after the initial printing of a Hebrew book. And you know, one of the foremost important Hebrew books that studied, the Talmud, had not been printed in its entirety yet.
Mm-hmm. Would you be able to compare, like, if you were to put it in today's dollars, how much the Bamberg Talmud would have sold in 1506?
It wasn't in 1506. It wasn't printed until 1520 to 1523, but
okay.
I can just to put that out there. But we actually do have, wonderfully, we have a record because princes and dukes and universities used to send their agents across Europe to the book printing centers to be able to purchase things that were coming out. And so we have actually a letter where an agent is being sent to the press, and we're told that the price of one of the Talmuds is some 20 gold florins, which was about the average salary of a skilled laborer, the average annual salary of a skilled laborer at that time.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking, if you're talking like an EUAW worker, we're talking anywhere around like $80,000.
And actually, that does seem a lot less than what it's sold for today. So
yes,
that's the point
of
being a collectible that's sold several years.
Hey, if I would have had the $80,000 back then. Anyway, so so do we have like a history of who owned this? How many of these were printed? How many are still known and existent? Or
that's a good question. It's what contributes to its rarity. We believe that by the beginning of the 16th century, they were printing close to 1,000 to 1,500 copies of every edition that they were publishing, every title that they were publishing, I should say. So there were probably around 1,000 of these printed, and there were, in fact, two editions. The first edition between 1520 and 1523, it sold out fairly quickly. There was a second edition between 1525 and 1539, and then there was a partial third edition in the 1540s. What that means is that Venice is the center of Hebrew printing. Was a place that people from all around the world, the Ottoman Empire, other parts of Europe, came to get their books, and there was quite a demand for this book, even though it was so expensive. What happened was, perhaps for a longer story, that there became a dispute over the Talmud and whether or not it contained anti-Christian texts, and the Pope in 1553, ordered the burning of the Talmud across Italy.
Well, let me interrupt. Wasn't this already discussed way back when, in the year 1000, when it was just in manuscript form and they took out parts?
Yes, you're absolutely right. There had been disputations about the Talmud going back hundreds of years. There was the famous burning of the Talmud in Paris in 1240. Manuscripts have been burned. The Talmud has actually been a very persecuted book. In fact, you know, one of those interesting questions is how many complete manuscript copies do we have of the Talmud? And the answer, which most people don't guess, is one. We have exactly one complete manuscript copy of the Talmud, which is incredible when you think about it. They're separate tractates, they're separate folios, they're separate leaves, but in terms of a complete manuscript, there's next to nothing.
When you say we, do you mean Sotheby's? You mean known in existence?
Known in existence.
Wow.
Yeah.
And where is that, if I could just interject?
That's in Munich. It's in the Staatsbibliothek in Munich.
Okay.
As a result of the public burning of the Talmud in 1553 in Rome, it occurred on Rosh Hashanah. It occurred in Venice, in San Marcos Square, in October of that year. Most of the copies of the first complete edition of the Talmud went up in flames.
Oh,
hundreds and hundreds of copies went up in flames. The only copies that survived were those that were out of the country, out of Italy at the time. And so we know of 12 complete original 16th century sets that are left. 10 of those are in public institutions around the world, and two of them are in private hands. This is one of those
two. Mm-hmm. Fascinating. So do we have a specific provenance of who bought this specific one, or were just the last couple people that...
No, it's actually a wonderful, wonderful history that goes back 500 years or so. This edition of the Talmud was bought and sent to London already in the 1540s. It was bought for Richard Bruarn, who was the Regius Professor of Hebrew at Oxford University from 1546 to 1556. He was a Christian, but he was interested in Jewish studies. And as somebody at the center, Oxford was a center of study, and still is a center of study, a very important scholastic enterprise. He must have had a little bit of wherewithal, and he sent for a copy of this, and it was brought back to him while he was a professor there in the 1540s.
So I suppose the university reimbursed him. It went under his professors get
to order
books.
We don't know if he had a slush fund for it or not. It's not clear. It's not clear. What is clear is that it wasn't considered the university's property. It was considered his property because in those days, when you bought a book, you didn't buy it bound. You took it home and had it bound with your personal binding by your binder. This particular copy of the Talmud was bound with the initials RB for Richard Bruarn on them. We know of other bindings of this same Richard Bruarn because after he passed away, he left his books to Oxford and then to one of the libraries in Oxford. And then after that, it devolved to Westminster Abbey by 1629.
Mm-hmm. And so Oxford said, we don't need this. We're just going to give it to that church.
We don't actually know. We lost. There are a few years there where we don't know why the books were transferred from Christ Church College in Oxford to Westminster Abbey.
Okay, so what year is it now in Westminster?
1629.
Okay, so it's only slightly less than 100 years.
Yes,
that it's
that's
in,
correct.
In Oxford. So 1620, it's sitting in the library of
Westminster Abbey.
Would you imagine people are actually using it, or is it just sort of something saying, oh, we got one of these sitting on the shelf?
It's in pristine condition.
It was sitting on the shelf.
It seems that nobody really used it. for the next 400 years. There's some idea that.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Could you? What is it? Is it on? Is it on vellum, meaning parchment? Is it on paper? How's the?
It's on paper. It's on. It's on wonderfully linen rag, acid-free, creamy white paper. It's some of the finest paper that was created in Europe in the 16th century, and you know that can last forever. I mean, parchment is even stronger. But and we do have some copies of this same edition, some tractates on parchment, not a complete set. But this paper is quite strong, and it'll keep going for the next 100 years.
Okay, so it's sitting on a shelf collecting probably lots of dust on in the library of Westminster Abbey. Where does it go next?
This is a wonderful story, which the previous owner, Mr. Jack Lunzer, tells very well. I'm going to try and approximate his incredible story. The previous owner of Val Madonna, Mr. Jack Lunzer, was a passionate book collector. And this edition of the Talmud is perhaps the golden fleece. It's the thing that people are looking for because it's so rare and so difficult to find an entire set. And his entire life he was searching for it. At one point, he lived in England, lives in England, Mr. Jack Lunzer. At one point in 1956, there was an incredible exhibition commemorating the 300th anniversary of the resettlement of the Jews in England. And all of the institutions in England sent in some object relating to Jewish history that they had in their collection. So the British Library sent manuscripts, and you know, various museums sent objects of Judaica. And it was a highly regarded exhibition. And Westminster Abbey sent one of the volumes from this Talmud. Mr. Jack Lunzer, custodian of the Val Madonna Trust Library, all of a sudden sees it and realizes that he's looking at potentially what might have been part of an entire set. And he is very excited about this. As he tells the story, he actually convinced a guard to let him turn the pages after hours. It's in today's day and age in museum
world,
as a curator, it couldn't have happened. But who knows, back in 1956, you know, what could have been.
He gave him a couple of quid and he said, sure thing, boss.
He waited till after the exhibition, and then he paid a visit to the library at Westminster Abbey, and he asked them if he might, you know, see it, and if there were perchance any other volumes. And in fact, oh yes, and we have 8 other volumes from this set, and there they are, and they're completely covered with dust. And Mr. Lunzer said, well, you know, I'm interested in Hebrew books, and I'd like to offer my services to have these professionally cleaned, and, you know, and really what he wanted to do was check all the pages and see if everything was there, I think. So he does that, and afterwards he makes an offer. He said, look, you know, you really haven't used this set for the last 400 years, and I would like to make an offer. You know, let's trade. You must have something you'd want to buy with the money. I will pay you what you like, and please, can we think about this? And they said, oh, no, Mr. Lunzer, this is our patrimony. We could never think about, you know, trading this or selling this in any way.
What was Westminster Abbey's like thrill with it? It's sitting on a shelf, it's gathering dust. It's not even a Christian book; it's a Jewish book.
Well, it's like all great libraries. You know, you have your jewels in your collection, even if they didn't understand quite. You know, once he offered money for it, they began to realize that it was a fairly important piece, and so they weren't going to give it up. Maybe they didn't need the money. It was Westminster Abbey, actually. So you know, libraries normally don't sell their books. It's especially libraries going back hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm.
Every year he would call them around the beginning of the year. He would wish them well. He'd ask them if they changed their mind, and they said no. This went on for 24 years. In the late 70s, he was sitting on a plane coming home from Africa because Mr. Lunzer did a lot of business with industrial diamonds. He was back and forth from Africa, and he picked up the newspaper as he was sitting in the plane, and he sees an article whereby the initial foundational charter to Westminster Abbey had been for sale at auction, and the British government decided after it had been sold not to give it an export license. Nowadays, we clarify that in advance, but in those days, it seemed that it had been clarified. And the person who had purchased it through a dealer was not from England and decided that, you know, they didn't want to live with it being somewhere else. They either wanted it or didn't. And he's sitting on the plane for the next 8 hours, and he's just shivering because he's
Spilkes, as we would say, yes.
On Spilkes, there's nothing he can do. There's no ground to air telephones in those days. And he gets back to London, and he calls up Westminster Abbey, and he speaks, and they say, "Ah, Mr. Lunza, we were expecting your phone call." And he does buy the charter and swaps it for the Talmud with supporting endowment funds. We don't know exactly how much more he paid over and above the charter, but he ended up with the Talmud.
Why didn't Westminster Abbey just buy the charter? It was up for sale.
Well, because it was. I think I did the math, and I tried to see how much in today's terms it would have been. It was about $300,000, I believe, for sale. And it's, you know, although you may have treasures in your collection, you may also not have $300,000.
Cash.
I think that's what it translated to. I think it was some 80,000 pounds or something. I'd have to go back and check, but accounting for inflation. And they probably just didn't have that at the time.
Wow. Okay, so so what year is this that he finally gets it?
He gets it in 1980.
1980, and he probably paid somewhere less than $1 million for it, we would assume.
Well, yeah, I guess you could say that, yes.
Okay, so he puts it in this library. Tell us about this library, the Valmadonna Trust Library.
Sure, the Valmadonna Trust Library is the product of one man's passion to collect Hebrew books, and through that show the scope and breadth of Jewish history for five centuries around the world. Really, every important Jewish community around the world is represented, except for America. Mr. Lenzer was not particularly looking towards America to collect. Nowadays, Judaica Americana has become a very, very important and sought-after and desirable area of collecting, but not back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, if you were European, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2009, Sotheby's held an exhibition where for about 2 weeks we put 10,000 of his books on display for the public, and thousands of people streamed through the door to see this incredible collection, the most important private collection of Hebrew books in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Lunzer, as he reached a certain age, decided that he would like to find a new home for his library, and consigned it to Sotheby's for sale.
Okay, so it's an entire library of like what I would
11,000 books.
What I would call mouth-watering pieces of Judaica.
Oh, absolutely! There's not an important Hebrew book culture that isn't represented there, from the miniature prayer books printed in Amsterdam to the newspapers printed in Shanghai and Calcutta in the 19th century, to books printed on parchment, to unicum, only known copies of Haggadot, to illustrated volumes. Anything you can think about in the last 500 years, you will find there. It's been an enormous privilege to be working with it for the last several years at Sotheby's.
Didn't Jack Lunzer make some sort of stipulation that the collection should be sort of like sold en masse, like he wanted to keep it together?
He did. He had originally requested that it be sold en bloc, as they say, together as one unit. And Sotheby's is trying to honor that. And one of the things that we did when we've had many potential buyers, there's been a lot of interest in the last 5 years, but because of a number of factors, most notably in 2009 because of the difficulties in the financial market, we hadn't been able to complete the sale. What we did was we sold a mere 12 volumes this past December from the collection, 11 manuscripts and the Bamberg Talmud, leaving 99.9% of the collection intact. As a sweeping and breathtaking collection of Hebrew books, and we hope to be able to sell the rest of that collection en bloc now to together.
Okay, yes. So the Bromberg Talmud, which, as you say, would be the crown jewel of this 11,000-piece collection from this library.
It would, but just to give you a sense, it's not the only jewel. I mean, the earliest Hebrew books that were printed before 1501 are called incunables. All books, Hebrew or Latin or secular, printed before 1501 are called from the cradle of, from the swaddling cloth of printing. And those are called incunables. Mr. Lenzer has the largest private collection of Hebrew incunables in the world. So, you know, that's still there and intact. There are many, many, many other really important pieces in this collection, mm-hmm. which are all still there.
I've been so enthralled with this conversation. I usually interject by this point like two times. If you're just tuning in, we are talking with Sharon Mintz, who is the senior consultant of Judaica at Sotheby's, and we're talking about the recent auction featuring the Bromberg Talmud, which went for $9.3 million. Are we at liberty to say who is the new owner of the Bromberg Talmud, Sharon?
The purchaser of record was a wonderful antiquarian book dealer, Stephen Lowenthal, and that's what Sotheby's is at liberty to disclose.
Uh-huh. Yeah, he's not affiliated with any type of academic organization. He didn't buy it on behalf of anybody that you really.
Dealers generally are when they're making an acquisition of that number, have a potential buyer.
Oh, he's just a broker.
But that's what Sotheby's is authorized to discuss. Uh-huh.
So yeah, when I was having this discussion with my friends before this, so I said, you know, it's just some oligarch is going to buy it, you know. So that's who else could afford such a thing? So this has been absolutely wonderful. I'm always fascinated by these type of things, and like I say, I wish I could at least afford the archiving that it would take to keep this book intact. So please keep us apprised of what else is going on with this Eldora Library, and we hope to have you back on again soon.
It would be my pleasure.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Absolutely wonderful. Just thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting me on to speak, and I look forward, if you're in New York, we'd be happy, or perhaps next year before December, Sotheby's has a Judaica sale every fall, usually in December. We can tune in, and I can apprise you of some of the other treasures coming up for sale. That would be wonderful.
That would be absolutely great. Take care. And if I could ask you to hold on the line when we break for the commercial, I have a question to ask you. So, but we're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour.
The Art Studio of Oak Park is now accepting students. Whether you're a real beginner or have been at it for a lifetime, the Art Studio of Oak Park has something for you. All levels welcome, all ages welcome. Private tutoring or small friendly classes. Flexible hours available. The Art Studio of Oak Park is very affordable. Make your life better. Put art into your life. The Art Studio of Oak Park offers lessons in a strictly kosher environment. Call today, 248-542-5087. That's 248-542-5087. It's great having an art room right in the neighborhood.
Hey, Schulfeman, here you are listening to The Jewish Hour. I am like goosebumps. I feel like, whoa, Kid in a Candy Shop doesn't even compare. This is just like what I feel like is, I suppose, what would be the effect of if a person was depressed and had like a lecture shop therapy, and she's like going, whoa, I feel great. That was amazing. I would really love to be able to sit down and learn a few folios of that Talmud. That would really make my life. Anyway, last week we played something from the Blue Melody Group, and we're going to do something again. They came up with something again this week. This time, Blue Melody is the backup people, and they play all kinds of Jewish music. This is an instrumental. The lead instrumentalist is a clarinetist known as Michel. He's French. Michel Camilo. The song is called Not Yet.
Thank you.
assurance of quality and excellence in kosher? Look for the Michigan K on the label. What's it look like? The Lower Peninsula of Michigan with a K. It's the symbol of the Michigan Kosher Supervisors. Go to their website, mikosup.com. That's M-I for Michigan, K-O for kosher, and S-U-P for supervisors, mikosup.com, and find this month's featured products. You'll find Michigan K products wherever fine food is sold, especially at Natural Food Patch on West 9 Mile Road in Ferndale.
Herschel Finman, here you are listening to the Jewish Hour. We have up for your listening pleasure. This is the Barcelona Gypsy Klezmer Orchestra. That says a whole lot right there. So we got Spanish gypsy and klezmer music all together. The piece is, it's a Jewish standard, Shalom Aleichem, which means welcome. Someone you know have an addiction to opiates? Ready to take your life back but don't have the time for a long inpatient program? MDS Drug Detox is a team of physicians with extensive experience in the field of rapid drug detox under anesthesia. MDS is the nation's only rapid opiate detox under anesthesia facility with the same doctors, RNs, and certified paramedics attending the entire drug detox process. MDS Drug Detox is safe and effective. Their goal is to provide the best, the safest, and the most economical way to free you from your addiction. MDS uses the highest standards of care and the best FDA-approved medications. MDS Drug Detox understands what your concerns are. Make the call today, 888-637-6968, or go online to www.mdsdrugdetox.com. That's 888-637-6968, MDS Drug Detox. Herschel Finman here. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. We customarily close with a slow, mournful, somber piece. The idea being like, oh, no. It's over. You know, we start with an upbeat piece. Yay, we're here.
So a couple of weeks ago, we actually closed with an upbeat piece. And our closers usually anywhere from 30 seconds to a minute, depending on how much time we actually have left. Somebody who said, please don't say my name on the air, but they were listening to an archived edition from a couple of weeks ago. And they contacted me and said, could you please play that closer? So for that person, the group is called The Shook. They are a Sephardic rock band. The piece is called Shalom Aleichem, which is not to be confused with the previous Shalom Aleichem. This is a Shalom Aleichem which is liturgical, which is sung Friday night right before the evening meal. Thank you so much for asking.
הקדוש ברוך הוא, איי איי איי, שלום עליכם, מלאכי השרת, מלאכי עליון. מלך, מלאכי המלאכים, הקדוש ברוך הוא, בואכם לשלום, מלאכי השלום, מלאכי עליון. מלכי המלכים, הקדוש ברוך הוא. ברוכים לשלום, מלכי השלום, מלכי עליון, ממלך מלכי המלכים, הקדוש ברוך הוא. איי איי איי, ברוכים לשלום, מלכי השלום, מלכי עליון, ממלך מלכי המלכים,
I go to a hospital to get healthy. At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800.
Herr Schulfenman, here you are listening to the Jewish Hour. The portion of the week is the portion of Va'era. Starts with chapter 10. At the beginning of chapter 12, we have what is referred to as the first mitzvah, the sanctifying of the new moon. And at that point, Moses is told that that Nisan, which is the month that Passover falls in, usually somewhere late March to anywhere to late April, is going to be the first of the month, which is really somewhat incredible because when you think Rosh Hashanah in Judaism, everybody thinks, oh, September time, 6 months afterwards. And indeed, and why is that? Is because Rosh Hashanah was the year, the time when Adam was created, when the creation was made, the universe was created. And so when Adam opened up his eyes, it was the first day of the month of Tishrei, which we today call Rosh Hashanah. And that was year one. There was no year zero. That was year one. Okay. Now what happened? Why is that? Is because up until the Exodus, the world was controlled by divine forces, which were under the guise of nature. They were limited to nature. There were miracles that happened. Yes, there were. But for the most part, it was all things natural. Comes along now the Exodus in the year 2448 after the birth of or the creation of Adam. And the Jews experienced the Exodus. What that did was to totally, completely upset the natural order. Because here you had, Egypt was a place that no slave had ever escaped from before. And you had en masse, 4 to 6 million people, maybe 7 million, I don't know how many exactly it were, 600,000 families, plus all their stuff, leaving Egypt in the blink of an eye to go to experience the splitting of the sea, which was the next greatest miracle, to eventually, 7 weeks later, receive the Torah on Sinai, which is the greatest miracle ever wrought. By doing so, the world now was able to transcend nature. When a person utilizes something of the mundane world, the realm of mundane, meaning you can use it, and uses it in such a way to somehow make the world a better place, they're elevating the mundane to the state of the holy. The world since that time has forever been changed. And now, okay, Rosh Hashanah is very important because that's a time when it's renewal and we have to do house cleaning. We have to make firm resolutions for next year. And we always talk about not just 5 pounds, how to make the world an awesome more than the previous year. But this is an indication of how we relate directly to the Almighty. There's a very interesting Hayom Yom, which is a book of aphorisms published by the Lubavitcher Rebbe in 1942, which says for, when was it? It was Friday, 2 days ago. Said, the Almighty gives the Jewish people physical things and expects them to turn those things into spiritual things. Thus, by fulfilling the whole reason why the Exodus, the splitting of the sea, the giving of the Torah occurred. We are running out of speedily out of time, speaking of which, don't go away. You're listening to the Jewish Hour.
Hi, this is Specs Howard from the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. We're happy to sponsor the Jewish Hour and bring quality radio programming to the community. While much of the funding for the Jewish Hour comes from its sponsors, it's listeners like you that help keep the Jewish Hour on the air. Please send your tax-deductible donation to The Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. That's 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. Your help is greatly appreciated.
Hey, Schulfenman here. You are listening to The Jewish Hour. Want to get in touch with me? The easiest way, of course, is to go to my website, RabbiFinman.com, RabbiFinman.com. What will you find there besides on the contact page? You'll find archived editions of the show, the last 5 weeks. If you get to the website sometime before this afternoon, so you can still hear like from 6 weeks ago, but this afternoon when I get home, I will upload this week's to it. And so it's only 5 weeks. So if you haven't listened in 6 weeks, go back and do that. You can also listen to archived editions that are older by going, of course, to iTunes, Stitcher on your smartphone, or to jcastnetwork.com. And there we have all the podcasts going back to 2009. I couldn't even do that. You'll also find archived editions of the E-Parsha, U-Parsha, Hasidic U-Story. These are different insights into the Torah, the holidays, whatever is happening in Judaism at the time, in other media other than radio format. It's not just listening. We do other things. You could read, you could see. And, of course, the very, very important donations page. It's the second week of January. It was incredible. Last week, sitting here at this microphone, I had no idea where December was going to come from, but lo and behold, people stepped up. I figured, first week of January, who's giving? But all those people that weren't giving in December, for whatever reason it was, maybe they're on vacation, maybe what, they came through, and we paid for December already. Now, all we need is January. December is gone. All we need is January. So if you haven't done it, if you haven't done it in a while, if you feel like doing it again, there's actually one person last week actually gave twice in one day. I guess maybe he's actually a regular contributor, and I guess he felt he needed to give more. But thank you very much. Any amount, rabbifinman.com. It'll keep us on the airwaves. We're approaching 20 years that we're on the air, and that's quite a something. So, go do it. Don't like using the internet? No problem, as we say. Drop me a line. The Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. You'll be glad you did. This story, I contacted the person to who the story is attributed to, meaning the storyteller, to find out the name of the protagonist, but haven't heard anything back from him till now. So we're just going to have to call him the rabbi. There was a certain rabbi in California who, this is back in the 60s. So it was probably, anyway, there's only 12 rabbis in all of California back in 1960, whatever. And he was had a small synagogue. And Friday night, he invited people to come back to his house. And people were sitting around, and they're doing a Friday night thing. And then there's a knock on the door. And a guy comes in, and he's got hair down to, as the story goes, down to his tuchus. He could sit on his hair, which is, people did that. That was like normal back then. And he sat down, and he just sat there silently. So they offered him a plate, some food. He didn't eat. He didn't say l'chaim. He didn't say a word. Nothing. After about an hour, because Friday night goes that long, he suddenly got up and he went over. There was a picture of the Rebbe, which was hanging on the wall. And he took the picture off the wall and he smashed it and said, "Why won't this man leave me alone?" So everybody pretty much, this is very shocking. You know, at this point, I'm starting thinking, call police. You know, what else is this guy going to do? So, but he sat down and he was very much, very jolted. He was, and the Yiddish word is fachadid. You could go look that one up. And he started to tell the story. He said he was born on the East Coast to a prominent, meaning wealthy, Jewish family from Long Island. And he decided that he's going to go to school in Berkeley, California, which was, like the height of, that's the pinnacle of hippieism is, Berkeley. And he was there in school for over a year and a half. And he was doing well in his studies and probably getting stoned quite a lot and doing all kinds of illicit drugs and engaging in what people engaged in the 60s. Like they say, if you could remember the 60s, you weren't there. And things were going fine. Some of his friends were dropping out because they just they were into tune in. What was the expression? Tune in, turn on, drop out. That was the expression, yeah. But he was still going to school. Suddenly, it was like December. He was like on break, and he wasn't planning on coming home. He was going to stay in California. he gets this urge to come home. He doesn't know where this urge is coming from, but he can't sleep. He's really thinking to himself, I really need to go home. He got the next day, picked himself up. You could do this back in the 60s, gets a plane ticket and goes home. And before he knows it, you know, 7 hours later, he's at his parents' door. Rings the, you know, doesn't have the key, I guess. Rings the bell. The mom opens the door, falls on his neck. Oh, I haven't seen you in a year and a half. His father comes and says, oh, I guess you came for the dollar. What was, he says, what are you talking about? He said, this man was very prominent figure in Jewish Federation. They called it the UJA back then. And they were planning a junket to Israel. This is probably right, I would say immediately after the Six-Day War. Like the either it was like 68, somewhere around there would make sense considering who the scenario the story goes. And he said, we went to the, as a group in mass, we went to the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And at this meeting that we had, this is called Yechidus Private Audience, we're discussing various things and going to Israel. And what does Israel need now? Now that it's got more land than it's tripled the size that it was before. And how can the UJA help? And the Rebbe was very, very insightful, which everybody knows. And at the end, the Rebbe gave everybody a dollar. To this man, the father, he gave $2. And he said, the second dollar is for your oldest son in college. So he's thinking to himself, my son is like tuned in, turned on, dropped out. I haven't seen him in a year and a half. I don't know if he's still breathing even. But he's, I got $2. Good, fine. So not a week went by later that the son shows up at the door. So he said, since then I've come back and I am just totally and completely tumulted is what this person is saying. My head, I can't, I've been so happy over here involved with all the things that people are involved with in the 60s. And now it's just not satisfying me. Why won't the Rebbe leave me alone? Let's jump ahead about 25, maybe 30 years. There's a Chaver Knesset whose name is Avner Shaki. And I actually heard Avner Shaki tell this story probably about 15 years ago. He's got some business in California. And he looked up, he asked, who's this? Is there Chabad Shlich in this place that he has to go? Because he knows if you got to go someplace, he's a religious member of Knesset, he needs a place for Shabbos, you call Chabad. Okay? I was once traveling Trans-Pacific and the plane stopped in Fiji. And on the bathroom wall, it said in Hebrew, if you need a place to stay, call this number. And it was Chabad in Melbourne. So everybody knows that Chabad's a place to stay. So he calls up and they says, okay, fine. He has it's a smaller city and there's a smaller minyan and there's about 15 people that are there and they stay for the whole synagogue and the meal and the whole thing all in the rabbi's house. In the middle of the meal, some very aggressive-looking people suddenly showed up. Okay, one of them was a biker dude with like a spiked leather band around his wrist. Another guy's got long hair, and they're definitely unkempt. And the rabbi, the member of Knesset, this Mr. Shaki, says, we were having such a nice Shabbos until these people come. Look, they're gluttonously devouring the food. What do you put up with these people for? The rabbi said to him, a couple decades ago, I did exactly the same thing. So why didn't the Rebbe leave that young man alone? I guess he needed to have another emissary in California. That's going to do it for the show today. Thank you for tuning in. We hope you had a chance to entertain you a bit. We hope you have a chance to educate you a bit. We hope you have a great week. We hope to see you back again next week. Take care.